The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is a program for people who are critical thinkers, independent minds, and progressive ideas. More than any other radio program in the United States, day in and day out, we look for solutions, we examine the problems without a political, religious, economic, or philosophical agenda backing. We're just looking for the truth wherever it is. And today, we're going to begin our program, normally on health and nutrition, but with a conversation with remarkable minds. This is one of our most popular series. We're going to look at a systemic, holistic perspective on how civilization is ripping itself apart at the seams. We're going to go to Sussex, United Kingdom. We have a lot of listeners in England. My guest to share insights on this problem is Dr. Naveez Ahmed. He is the Executive Director of the Progressive Institute for Policy Research and Development, a British independent organization for transdisciplinary security studies and analyzing violent conflict in the context of global ecological and energy and economic crisis. He also teaches international relations theory and empire and globalization studies, School of Global Studies at the University of Sussex. He's the author of a best-selling book, The War on Freedom, and he's with us now. He also has a new book, A User's Guide to the Crisis of Civilization. Nice to have you with us today, sir.
It's my pleasure, Gary. Thanks for having me on.
And let me also remind our viewers that we're broadcasting live from our studio in New York, and you can watch today's show by going to progressiveradionetwork.com or GaryKnoll.com. I'm going to give you a longer, larger overview than what you might normally expect in a conversation, and then stay quiet and let you address it, all right?
Excellent.
First and foremost, at least on this program, we've taken a look at the way that we process our lives. Let me give you an example of that. We never talk about how we abuse nature. It's there to be exploited in our minds. If we see a beautiful countryside, we look at it, 5-acre developments and what that will bring to the developer who's going to capitalize on it and the people living there. We don't ask ourselves, is this the best place to be living? Are we over congested? Do we have enough natural resources? The same would be true for looking at China and India, two of the major growing powers economically in the world. Both will be somewhere between 6 to 10% growth, along with Brazil. We simply look at how much their growth is, how many people are becoming more upper middle class or graduating from college or able to enjoy a lifestyle that you in the United Kingdom, we in the United States have taken for granted. Steak with dinner or lunch, flat screen TVs, anything that a person wants, we believe they deserve. That's our mindset. But no one stops and says, okay, how are we supposed to continuously feed our addiction to ever-increasing consumption? Is there a point to where we finally tip, where there's no longer enough raw materials, whether it's silver or cobalt or manganese or some mineral necessary in this supply chain, or water for these cities that are being built? 16 of the 20 largest cities in the world are in China, to supply people with their water. Do we actually look at these? And I want you to address that. Now, here is the latest. And this is from the Institute of Policy Research, and it says, global warming, energy shortages, food scarcity, and recession could cause an industrial failure. We're not talking about 20 years now. We're talking about failure within 10 years. Recently, I filmed the gentleman. You saw the film Jurassic Park?
Yep.
Okay, well, the Jeff Goldblum character in there is a real character in life, a chaos theorist, professor at UCLA, and I filmed him for a current film I'm doing. And I ask him a simple question. Weren't you one of about 1,900 scientists who had a consensus the Larsen B shelf that was supporting and buffering the major glacier in Antarctica would not break for 100 to 10,000 years? And he says, yes. Didn't it break 19 days later? He says, yes. I said, weren't you all wrong? But I mean major wrong. It wasn't 100 years. It was 19 days. He said, here's what he said. He said, Gary, as we speak and in the foreseeable future, events within nature are changing at such a rate that there is no accurate mathematical model as to when the oceans are going to rise and to what degree, as to when the hurricanes will come or other cataclysmic events. And so at one time we thought we could predict these fairly accurately, but we can't today. So if anyone gives you some guarantee that the current generation doesn't have to worry about global warming, water resources, drought, food shortages, that person is a person you should not trust because they do not have accurate mathematical models or science on their side. Now, I simply raise this with you to begin our conversation because nowhere on CNBC, on Fox, on ABC, NBC, PBS, no one is talking about the idea that we could be facing major sustainable droughts, food shortages, ecological tipping because of how we're planning and living our lives. That's my introduction. Take your time, please. The forum is yours.
Thanks so much, Gary. I think, well, you've done a really fantastic job, actually, of summing up our predicament and some of the problems with the way we approach these issues. And I think, really, this was my concern when I started out writing this book, which was about 5 years ago. I was growingly concerned by the fact that different experts were always looking at a piece of the puzzle. So you had some guys looking at climate change, and you had some other guys looking at, you know, maybe energy depletion, oil depletion. You had some other guys looking at the economy, you know, the economists. And you had, you know, people looking at agriculture, and then you've also got security experts looking at terrorism. And it became increasingly clear to me as I was doing the research for this book and, you know, going through the scientific papers, the industry reports, that you know, people weren't connecting the dots. And in fact, precisely what you were saying, Gary, about, you know, the fact that nature is actually, nature works on the basis of very complex systems. In fact, it's not just one complex system. It's an infinitesimal number of complex systems which are interlocked in ways that we can barely fathom. And we're kind of racing to try and develop kind of accurate models to understand how nature works. You know, and we've made a lot of progress over the last few years. You know, certainly last 40 years, you know, we've made, you know, drastic strides in our scientific knowledge of how the world works. But what's now becoming clear is not that, you know, that actually our projections are too alarmist and that, you know, we don't really have anything to be worried about. But actually, because we're only looking ever at one kind of single facet of the problem, we're not seeing the bigger picture. So we're not seeing the inherent interdependencies between these different systems. And because we're not seeing those inherent interlinkages, we have missed the bigger picture and the fact that there are feedback loops between these systems, so between the climate system, for example, the energy system, the economic system, even you know, our underlying value systems and so on and so forth. These feedback loops that we're not looking at illustrate how fundamentally interconnected these crises are, and that rather than us not having anything to worry about, actually, as these crises get worse on their own terms, they're increasingly likely to feed back into each other. And this will create further difficulties in actually modeling what's likely to happen. And so, you know, in my book, I tried to come up with a kind of like a map of a worst-case scenario. And I'm an optimist in the long term. You know, I firmly believe in the human spirit and in our capacity to better ourselves and to better our societies. But, you know, being pragmatic, you know, you have to have an understanding of the contingencies. And the contingencies are very worrying. It looks like over the next 10 years, we could see a major convergence of energy scarcity, impacting on our ability to produce food under the concurrent industrial corporate system, which will also have a feedback effect with the economic system, which is already generating its own internal tensions and crises, as we see with the financial crash, and that this will also be compounded by ongoing changes in the environment, environmental degradation and climate changes, which we can already see, various studies have shown, are also impacting on food production, reducing crop yields and so on and so forth, you know, kind of leading to escalating droughts, especially in food basket regions. And so all of this, I think, is likely to converge, and we could see a major failure of mainstream state agencies and their ability to deliver public goods and services. I believe it could happen within 10 years. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, that we're going to see a simultaneous, instantaneous collapse of everything within 10 years. You know, I don't think that's plausible. But it does mean that we will increasingly see government strained. And strained to an extreme extent, where, you know, it may be, you know, governments may find it convenient actually to increasingly securitize these crises, and by that I mean not look at the root causes, not look at the systemic structural causes, which would require us to have a progressive transformation for the benefit of the majority of people, not just in the planet, but also in specific countries such as the United States and the United Kingdom. But they will be looking more towards maintaining the global political economy and the kind of the unequal structures, the power of vested interests, the banking and financial conglomerates. And so, you know, in order to do that, the idea was really to kind of divert attention from the failure of the existing system and look at kind of things that, you know, we can really easily see, you know, differences in color, ethnicity, race, religion, gender, focus on, you know, sexuality, focus on things that you can easily separate people out and say, no, that's the problem, those people are the problem. And that's what I'm worried about, that, you know, as these crises accelerate, we could see an emergence of very, very disturbing tendencies towards demonizing different populations, different people from different backgrounds. And that could really make things a lot worse, you know, by focusing more on militarization. You know, that would accelerate any kind of process of collapse.
Okay, I appreciate that overview. I would like now to go into some specifics, and once again, I'm going to be bringing some pieces of a puzzle together and asking you, after you hear what I'm saying, does this make sense to you? All right? Let's just say that everything that you've been looking at and others have been looking at concerning more futuristic, where people are taking a look and saying, all right, how can we better feed the world's population? And we assume that if we're in the first world, in the United States or in France and Germany, England, that we don't have to worry about food. You know, it's always been there, we have the means of producing it, and we'll continue. Yet, here comes the wrinkle. Along comes a company such as Monsanto that now controls 90% of the world's genetically modified crops, and in some cases, 100% of the crops grown, for example, types of corn, types of soybean, and types of sugar beets, are then genetically engineered. They then put their people, like Michael Taylor, former top person from Monsanto, into the Food Safety Administrator position Obama does, and hence he becomes the person that oversees all food safety, and yet he is there with his own agenda, genetically modified foods. Now, we've seen the consequences of genetically modified cotton in India. We've seen a country that at one time, even though poor, many farmers had the ability to grow their own local heirloom foods and then share them. If you had 100 farmers in one village, one would grow cashews, another would grow peanuts, another would grow lentils, and then they shared them. Poor, yes. Hungry, no. Then along came the Green Revolution, and all that was taken away, and now there's 100-acre or 1,000-acre or 10,000-acre parcel where you have one crop, a monocrop, that's genetically engineered to withstand an unlimited amounts of pesticide poured on it. So more pesticides, more denaturing of the soil, less diversity of crops, the complete destruction of 75% of all the heirloom seeds ever existing has occurred in the last 30 years. And yet the average person goes to the refrigerator, opens it up, sees everything they'd ever want to eat. They take their selection, they walk into a supermarket, everything they want. They don't see what's coming. They don't seem to see the problem of that. That's one example. Next, we just determined through going back to an old 2006 Wall Street Journal article, there was a man in the United States, you may or may not have heard of him, called Charles Koch. And he and his brother each are worth about $24 billion, which makes them together $50 billion. They acknowledge the following. Listen carefully, because this falls right into what you and others are doing. They talked about how they're coordinating behind the scenes all conservative infrastructures, meaning front groups that take out scientists and generals and colonels and retired secretaries of defense to promote war, endless war. They have political campaigns that they sponsor, think tanks, many of the top think tanks in the United States and around the world that are called upon by legislative bodies to tell them, what should we do about our water resources? What should we do about desalinization? What should we do about urban planning? The think tanks supply the experts. The experts are paid for by the Koch Industries. Well, now, I give you all this because these are the people whose philosophy is culture of prosperity. They want to eliminate 90% of all laws and government regulations. These are the same people, and with others, who got Bill Clinton to hire Robert Rubin from Goldman Sachs, Larry Summers from Harvard, and Tim Geithner, and then with one congressman from Texas, Phil Graham, repealed the Glass-Steagall Act that allowed all of the major crises you see today economically on Wall Street, from derivatives and credit default swaps, to exist. So here you've got two brothers, two individuals that the average American has never seen, never heard of, and they control through their banking and oil industries and health insurance. They got it all. They make sure that if you're fully covered by your insurance, and you, if you, Professor Achmed, you went into a hospital in the United States and you said, I just had two fingers severed in an accident, and they check your insurance, they say, well, we can't allow you to have both fingers reattached. Select the one you want. You say, but I'm fully covered. They say, well, but we decide, not your doctor, not you, and not the emergency room, what's going to be paid for and what you're going to have. And you say, but why? If I'm paying you my bills, why are you denying me the right to have my severed finger? And they're going to say, well, that's our policy. What they are not saying is, because we make 33 to 37% of all the money in healthcare, $2.6 trillion this year, and the people behind this are the Koch brothers and others, that we never see, this relatively small group of these elite, industrial elite, and they're doing everything. We see their hands in the Tea Party movement. We see it in the Republican movement. We see it in the Democrat movements, the Blue Dog Democrats. So then one day you get up in front of the world, as you have, and rightly so, and you say, you better pay attention to where we're going. Global warming is real. The Tea Party people on the right and Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck says, no, it's not. So the Congress does nothing. Zero. You get up and say, that we should be lowering the military industrial budget. Britain's doing it by 20%. We increase ours right now over $1 trillion. We could reduce that by 80% and still be completely covered. They say, you're not going to touch that. We'll have 1,000 generals and 1,000 professors saying, if we reduce one penny of our budget, we are susceptible to Islamic terrorists and they'll blow us up in our sleep. And they know how. They've got the media, they got the talking heads. Every single talking head I see on Keith Urban, or I see on Bill, what's his face, over on O'Reilly on Fox, I question, because they're coming from the same places, the same people. These are not a single progressive mind do I ever see, ever, in American media. I don't see Chris Hedges. I don't see Gerald Salante. And I don't see you on a lot of these. So taking that into consideration, taking into consideration that Goldman Sachs threw up the price of oil from $47 to $147 a barrel when they were working at Citigroup, trading back and forth the shares where the average person may have had not to have the heat because they couldn't afford the oil. They didn't care. Now you look at the world and you look at the fact that, yes, we're going to have starvation. Yes, we're going to have droughts. We're going to have flooding. We're going to have global warming. And no one politically is going to have the power to do a damn thing about it because we have no progressives in office. And we have the people like this controlling everything behind the scenes. Now, when you put that into the equation, honestly and objectively, what do you see the consequences? Please take on any of the issues I just shared with you.
Well, Gary, you've actually given a really interesting interlocking summary of the issues that we're dealing with, and really the kind of almost overwhelming nature of the way these things are interlocking. And I think the example of Koch Industries is really apt, because as you said, these guys have got their hands in the Tea Party movement, tied to the Republicans. They're investing in very dodgy agricultural practices related to GM. They're also involved in the fossil fuel industry, and the same guys are funding the climate skeptic think tanks, which are actively publishing shoddy denialist kind of literature about climate change. So this it's very clear to me, Gary, that you're already very, very interdisciplinary in the way you're looking at these things. And I think this is part of the solution. We need to start having more voices like yours, more like mine, like others who are looking at the bigger picture and piecing them together. But to answer your specific question about what would the consequences be, given the, I think you're focusing very much on the lack of a kind of meaningful progressive response to these issues, which, I agree with you. Actually, here in the UK, we have a very similar problem with, the kind of emasculation of the progressive movement here. It's very disturbing, I mean, the most that you get really is kind of, let's get troops out of Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's probably about as far as it goes in terms of really critiquing the structures that we face. I think the issue of food production that you started with summarizes and kind of encapsulates where we are, because if you look at the situation as it stands at the moment with the Green Revolution, which seemingly for a while was producing enough food to theoretically feed the world, and even now we have to recognize that a lot of the reason, one of the main reasons why we have inequalities in terms of mass hunger in many parts of the less developed world is because of an unequal food distribution system. Where we have, as you gave the example of India, where you have these less developed countries which are producing food, which most of the land is owned and controlled by a tiny minority of corporations based in the West, as well as in the United States, and they export food very, very cheaply, in return, they have to buy food from us that we produce, and we sell this food to them at extortionate prices, which basically the majority of people in these countries can't afford. So effectively, this is an unequal system that generates hunger and malnutrition. Now, on top of that, what's happening is that the logic of the ideology that we find ourselves in, an ideology in which we feel that we are the overlord of nature, we control everything, and everything is subordinate to our imperative to consume endlessly in order to maximize ourselves in a completely material way. So we define ourselves in a very material way. We define our well-being in a very material way. And I think this certainly chimes with the work that you've been doing over the last few decades in terms of health and the way we understand health and well-being. Well, so that mindset, that mindset penetrates the way we run our economies. It penetrates the way we understand the earth. So we don't recognize limits. So this industrial system of agriculture has gone throughout the world, backed by gumbo diplomacy. We now have the vast majority of the earth's fertile land already under use. As you mentioned, the soil is now being degraded at rates which the natural rate of reproduction can't keep up. We're also exhausting our hydrocarbon resource base. Now, obviously, industrial agriculture is dependent on fossil fuels, both in terms of the oil and gas that we need to power technological-style agriculture, as well as in fertilizers and pesticides. So we're now reaching a limit on that front. You know, currently, according to even a company like British Petroleum, who, you know, every year they release a report on reviewing energy reserves, and they always say we have about 40 years before world oil production peaks. And the latest report that was released earlier this year proves the opposite. The actual data speaks for itself. It shows that world oil production was rising rising inexorably until about 2004, 2005, that it stopped, it plateaued through to around 2008. It's currently declining. It declined in 2008 and is continuing to decline. And that is unprecedented. That has never happened before in the history of world oil production. We have never seen a global production plateau and a decline. So that's very worrying. It suggests that in terms of conventional oil, the age of cheap oil may well be over. That's obviously going to impact on our ability to continue to produce food, but not just food. It will impact on our ability to do everything, because everything that we do is based on energy. And this really is what the fundamental issue that goes against the grain of the kind of neoliberal kind of economists and the ideology that you said that as you see the people like George Soros, the other financiers who are driving this incessant kind of growth, it goes against that, because the economy is embedded in its environment. You cannot separate the economy from the environment. You cannot separate humanity from the natural world. And what's happening is that nature is now forcing us to recognize the limits. It's forcing us to say, look, you know, you cannot continuously grow to an infinite level on a material scale on a finite planet. You need to exist in harmony with the earth, in harmony with the natural order. Now, on food production, on climate change, on energy scarcity, and I've really just skimmed the surface here, we're seeing all of these issues now reaching a limit. And the economy is really only the surface symptom of this crisis. It's very clear that the economic recession was partly driven by the rocketing oil prices in 2008, which kind of escalated the debt defaults and made it very difficult for your average person, your average consumer, to continue to repay their debts. But that's also a function of the fact that the neoliberal economy systematizes debt, and that's another issue which is very important to see, that because the financiers have found it very, very difficult to continue growing on the basis of real-world economics, things like manufacturing, buying and selling, they moved into the realm of financialization, as you said, trading in commodities, trading in fictional financial instruments, creating new kinds of financial instruments, selling them on, insuring them when you didn't actually have the capital to insure them. And on that basis, building up this mountain of debt, which wasn't real, but was the basis of the growth that we've had over the last two decades or so. So that bubble that we've built, that bubble is now crashing, is coming down around our heads. And unfortunately, mainstream policymakers, whether it's due to ideology or it's due to vested interests or it's due to a pure Machiavellian instinct or whatever it is, they're not seeing the wood for the trees. They're not waking up. So, you know, it looks grim at first sight. But one thing that is clear to me, if you look at if you study the rise and fall of civilizations in history, it's not the first time that a civilization has faced difficulties or perhaps even collapsed due to these kind of things. And there's also instances in the past where we've seen that civilizations have been able to renew themselves. Very, very few examples. I mentioned one or two examples in the book. But you know, there is, for me, if you look at the history of how this thing goes, I think that there is a possibility that as things do get worse as progressive movements continue to kind of not really deal with the issues, and as mainstream policymakers continue business as usual, things will get worse. But that will also create a space for communities to reclaim the kind of political space that the progressives have occupied, and say, well, actually, look, you guys aren't truly progressive. Because we need a fundamental, drastic transformation of our values, of our economic system. Our economic systems need to be based on communities having greater access to production and greater control over production. We need to have much more kind of wealth distribution. We need to stop relying on fossil fuels, which is you know, our dependency on oil is getting us into these wars. For example, we need to start being much more localized, relying on distributed renewable energy systems, and we need to change our whole understanding of what life is all about, in a way that, you know, prosperity isn't about consuming endless quantities of material goods. That maybe prosperity and well-being is actually about being content and living in harmony with nature and with each other. Now, I don't pretend that, you know, I've got all the answers, but I certainly think that there is a dialogue that needs to take place, and that dialogue will become more urgent as things get worse.
I appreciate the insight you're sharing with us. I just have a couple more areas I'd like to explore. One will be specifically on solutions, and that will be my last question and statement. But right now, one more thought on this. I believe that Glenn Beck, when he's attacking progressives, as in his mind is the most dangerous thought form on earth, and ties it into Marxism and communism, none of that being true, that those of us who are progressives have not used the influence and power in a collective way that we can. Now, almost all the progressive I know are neither Republican nor Democrat, conservative nor liberal. They're independent. So I see that there is a transformation that goes from someone who believed and truly believed that the answers to the problems in the world were due more often than not to the other party, the other religion, the other race, the other economic class, the other educational system, and without looking at the role they played in the problem. It was always outside. I believe that at a certain point, there is a crisis of conscience where a person wakes up one day, looks in the mirror, and realizes that most of their life is based upon a story written for them that they are the master readers of, that are based upon myths. And these myths perpetrate at every level. An example, there are almost 1 million physicians in the United States. You have under 3,000 practicing what is known as complementary, alternative, or holistic medicine. Many of these are board-certified physicians. In order to be able to practice complementary medicine, they had to go out and master additional fields, whether it's homeopathy or herbs, nutrients, chelation, hyperbaric oxygen, whatever it may be. And then another group, including some psychologists, psychiatrists, had to go out and master the skills of the brain working with the mind. Hence, mindful meditation and mindful stress management, understanding the role of stress and distress, and being able to act appropriately when you are faced with the stress, instead of imploding and reacting and allowing those subconscious tapes to go off, in which case you are helpless at your solution. And then one day someone looks at the school teacher who goes to school, and they start to teach, and they stop for a moment and say, what am I teaching? How is what I'm teaching going to prepare this child for the world that we're living in today? I'm teaching this child how to pass a test. This kid has gotten special books on just passing the test. They're getting special tutoring on passing the test so that my class, my school district will get more funding and get better rating because we pass more students on this particular test. Yet we're graduating illiterates. They know nothing about history, the world, interrelationships, philosophy of life, civics. They know nothing about other cultures, other religions, the people they're actually going to have to integrate with and work with in the real world. What am I doing? That's a crisis of conscience. Now the person is least mindful that the very comfortable belief systems that people have been living with don't answer the questions in the real world. And then they become independent. in that moment of becoming independent, there's both sadness and there's fear. Sadness that you're having to surrender what you thought was the right answer, the right reality. But then one day you wake up and you see that there are two realities. There's the personal truth that you were taught and conditioned to believe, and then there's the universal truth that is based upon a spiritual alliance, that we are all interconnected, and that when you treat a person as a human being, as a sacred being, you cannot then vilify them, demonize them, abuse them, use them, manipulate them. They're not just a commodity. George Soros said something on 60 Minutes that was unique. When asked years ago about how he made his money and how he used currency manipulation, he says he doesn't look at the morality of how he makes his money. Jump over to Madeleine Albright being interviewed by Leslie Stahl in 60 Minutes and talking about the 500,000 Iraqi children who died because of the sanctions put in place by Clinton. And the idea was, as papers later came out, that our Defense Department, our military-industrial complex, decided that by blowing up the power stations, against the Geneva Convention, and their water purification systems, that the poor people would not have access to private water supplies, their children would develop diseases like typhoid and cholera and die, the public then would rise up against Saddam Hussein. Well, that was stupid logic. They didn't rise up, they couldn't rise up, and they died. And when asked, are 500,000 dead children and the sanctions that caused it worth it, Madeleine Albright on 60 Minutes said, yes. She wasn't saying yes by herself. As an ambassador and a Secretary of State, Ambassador to the UN Secretary of State, she was saying yes on behalf of all of the Washington insiders, including the Clintons. But what if you said, we're going to take 500,000 of the wealthiest family children in the United States, Bill Gates' kids, your kids, Chelsea Clinton, and they are going to be the next 500,000 to die? And they're going to say, no, you're not going to kill my kid for any reason. Oh, you mean an Iraqi child does not have the same value as your child? And you start seeing how the conditioning in our society has perverted the very basis of spirituality. In our church, our mosques, our temples, our synagogues are merely grotesque aberrations of spiritual enlightenment, but very capable of religious indoctrination and the rituals that come from that. Those are my own personal feelings. I'm not to ask you or anybody else to subscribe to that, because some of the greatest warmongers and hatemongers come from these religious institutions and the scripture they read. There seems to be this schizophrenia in our society that we cannot differentiate. Well, in chapter one of this book, it says you can have slaves and bash a baby's head against a rock, and you can rape all the women in this village, and yet, what if you chose to believe that? Would that then justify your acts? Are you a true believer? But in another chapter, it says, no, you should forgive people. Well, if there's both in the same book, how could it be written by the same person? It was written by 1,000 people. Why can't we even be honest about who writes these religious comic books? Why can't we even be honest about how perverse their religion has become and how it has dominated the critical thinking and the actions of people and what it has allowed in the name of itself? Because a lot of the wars we're in are to make sure that our democracy and our God is first and foremost. Just look at Glenn Beck. God is everything. He's channeling God. But so did George Bush. So you can't leave this out of the equation. And then you come back, and my final thought is, you come back to where at some point this person realizes, my God, what have I been? I know what I have not been. A person honoring my own life, instead allowing others to tell me how I should master my life on their path and tell my story that was written by them. And if you're living through someone else's myth, then you will never have that day of completeness, wholeness, and perfect synergy and synchronicity in a constructive way. Because in the final analysis, when we look at the ecological insight of the progressive mind that allows an a symbiotic relationship to exist between humans and society, nature and humans and society, and the complete environment, then the social and economic sustainability is there. You start looking at how do you sustain yourself? How do you sustain a community and a society? And the answers are self-evident. If you do not, then you look at modern civilization and you look at the catastrophe that it has become and you look at the scarcity of resources, but of no concern to you because you're sure that your government, your scientists, your university, the talking heads on television, your political parties will pull you out at the last moment. They're sure to. That's why you voted them in. That's what they promised. But it doesn't work that way. And I believe that the only way we will have a future that will be bright is when the 42% of all American voters who are actually independent and the 5% who are progressives within the next 5 to 6 years realize, as bad as it will get under President Hillary Clinton, and mark my words, she will be the next president running against Sarah Palin, and there will be more blue dog Democrats, there will be more rules expunged, there will be more manipulation, privatization of everything. You won't be able to live in our society unless something is privatized at that point, all for the good of the people. Then the progressives will start to come together, will start to form alliances and form a formidable party, and then we will demand not reform, because real progressives do not want reform. Reform is a game. We want transformation. And transformation means we will have health care for all, and it will actually be health. We will learn from those doctors and ask, if 2,000 of you are holistic in preventing disease and using non-invasive treatments to help people get actually well, then what about the 997,000 of you who are not? Those are based upon paradigm believers, true believers, fear of change and reward for what they do. Even when they fail, they're rewarded. And that, I believe, will be challenged in the future. The progressive will challenge it. The Democrat and Republican will not. The existing system cannot change the future. So by people giving their support to the Green Party, the Tea Party candidates, the Republicans, Democrats are making an egregious error in judgment. But I believe that we must watch this error and watch it manifest. But at the same time, change our lives individually, collectively. Start looking, only buy organic, shop locally, get rid of, don't shop in Walmarts, don't buy anything that pollutes the planet. Be conscientious, stop overconsumption, be conscious of the issues, and start to unite as individuals. Those are my thoughts. I would like to hear yours, sir.
Yeah, thanks, Gary. Again, very insightful analysis of the role of ideology, especially religious ideology, myth-making, in really controlling our lives, other people's myths, as you said. And interestingly, myths that are constructed by those in power in order to legitimize their vested interests and legitimize the unequal structure of a global political, economic, and ethical system, which is actually very unjust and inherently self-destructive. In terms of solutions, I fully agree with you that There's a real, really powerful space for action. We don't need to just look to the mainstream parties or to the powers that be and kind of hope and pray or lobby. And I'm not saying we shouldn't lobby. I'm not saying we shouldn't get involved. Absolutely, we need to show our hand. We need to make sure that we are out there voting, whoever it is that we do vote for, preferably the better candidate. And I know sometimes it's like choosing between two devils, but sometimes we do need to get out there on the streets and show that, well, look, you can't just act like we don't exist. So I'm all for engaging with the existing system, but in the consciousness that it's a broken system, and in the consciousness that, as you said, tinkering with reforms around the edges is not really going to deal with the problems and the sheer gravity, the systemic nature of the problems, and the inherently interdependent nature of the crises that are coming, that are basically already here. We're now seeing the manifestations of these crises. We need to start thinking about transformation. And one of the things I tried to do when I wrote this book, I tried to look at what would an alternative kind of post-carbon harmonious civilization look like? You know, rather than kind of coming up with a set of kind of, well, let's tinker with this policy, this thing with that policy, I thought, well, what actually should it do? And when you look at that, and obviously I had to undertake a kind of theoretical critique of the existing system. So I looked at the structure of the economy. I looked at the overwhelming centralization of political power. I looked at issues like some of the ownership of productive resources, the skewered wealth distribution practices, why these things are happening, why the fiscal system isn't working. I looked at things like ideas about, you know, what is the kind of prevailing view that underpins all of this about our place in the world. And, you know, this is a subliminal thing. You know, people obviously have different religious and philosophical perspectives, but there are these subliminal ideas which pervade and kind of legitimize our everyday practices, practices of consumption and production, the way we engage with other people, what we think is important in our lives. And when you put it all together, you know, I really think that the civilization that we want to be working towards, ultimately, that all the threads are pointing towards greater participation of communities, more localization of power, rather than trusting someone else to do everything for you. The trend line towards a truly progressive system seems to be no. Actually, communities need to take power back. They need to take power back politically, and that needs to be tied indelibly to economic power. So that means actually taking power over concrete material wealth in terms of, you know, who controls the mineral wealth, who controls the oil, who controls the water, who controls the gas, who controls the different mineral resources, who controls all of these things. Well, it shouldn't be a tiny minority in the interests of themselves. It should really be the communities. Now, how we do that, how we organize that, very complex question. There are different models that are being explored in different parts of the world. I'm very conscious that we don't want to go down the roads of failed systems, such as the discredited Soviet system. No way do we want to go down a totalitarian system. But what we don't want is centralized minority control in their own interests. The community needs to be involved in how resources are used. They need to be done in a way which is ecologically sound. And of course, all of that needs to be tied in with a complete restructuring of the way we exchange goods, the way we use money. You know, money needs to be changed. It needs to be, right now money is based on debt. The very creation of money under the US Federal Reserve System, as well as the Bank of England system here in the UK, as well as all over the world, is based on escalating debt. You create money by literally creating debt. You're giving out hundreds more than what you actually have on your reserves. And it used to be called fractional reserve, but actually it's changed now. It changed in the year 2000 under what was called the New Capital Accord that was brokered by the Bank for International Settlements.
Could we do this? We have several more areas that I need to get into, including going further into ideas on the nature of redistribution of power, but that is going to require much more time than what I have. Could I invite you back for part two?
I'd be delighted to come back and speak to you again, Gary.
Great. Also, I would like your insights on more on 9/11. I didn't even have a chance to get with that, and I don't want to cut that short. I want to talk about some things on 9/11 I have concerns about on the official report and what some contradictions in. So, and also on the banking system, the debt system, who benefits from the debt system, and how we can take ourselves as much as possible off the power grids of life to start being more powerful within our own lives. Could you come back and share that with us?
I'd be honored to come back again, Gary, and speak to you.
I look forward. Then we will have, in the very near future, the next week, we'll have part two of my conversation with Professor Nafiz Ahmed, A-H-K-M-E-D, is professor over in England, the author of The War on Freedom, and certainly a continuation of our conversations with remarkable minds. I'm Gary Nall. We have a little bit of time left, but I didn't want to have him rush through his answers. He is just too informative to do that, so I'm going to bring him back for another full hour. I am going to allow you a chance now to call in and share your points of view on what we've discussed today. 888-874-4673. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And while you're waiting, coming in on the calls, and I look forward to taking them, just one quick program and announcement here. We're going upstairs. We just got our new improved Power Berry Blast in this morning. We were out. They asked, could I give a great special, something I wasn't even giving the first time. So thank the people upstairs in cells. Here's what we're giving you. We're giving you the new and improved Power Berry Blast. That's the highest ORAC antioxidant content of any product I know in the world that you're going to consume. 15,000 ORAC. That means antioxidants from 20 different fruits. Only 40 calories, by the way, so it's great for diabetics. And only 1 gram of sugar. It's all natural. And this is the ultimate raw, all natural, 22 fruits and berries, antioxidants. It has the acai berry. Some call it acai berry. You can pronounce it acai or acai. It has, it is just the best of the best. And it's a big, big jar. 500 grams, but most importantly, when you look at the label, you will see that in a lot of products out there, they try to say, oh, you get this, this, and this, and then you see the milligrams, 10 milligrams, 20 milligrams. Yeah, they got 40 items in there, and they give you enough that wouldn't keep a cockroach alive. Listen carefully. Acai berry, 1,525 milligrams. Cranberries, 1,500 milligrams. Goji berries, 1,500. Red raspberry, almost 1,500. Strawberries, almost 1,300. And then you get the blueberries and elderberries and noni and black cherry and black raspberries and blueberry leaf extract and organic camu camu and black currants and pineapple and guava and red raspberry seed extract and grape seed extract, 200 milligrams of that, by the way, and then aronia and then bilberry extract and quercetin. It's Circle K kosher. It is the ultimate raw. It is the ultimate thing I've ever made. Tastes great, new and improved, and you're going to get it today. All the funds go to this non-commercial radio station for what is it? It's what it's for. It's $99, and plus you're getting a choice of a DVD, Power Foods Baby, a book, Power Foods Baby Boomer's Guide or Power Healing. So you're getting a savings of almost what, $60-$70. Whoa! Call now. 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. This is only good for today. 877-627-5065, and ask for your new and improved Power Berry Blast. 15,000 ORAC, nothing like it in the world. In fact, there's nothing like this product in the world. 877-627-5065. I'm Gary Nall. I have a whole lot of questions on 9/11 that I'm going, and since he testified before the 9/11 Commission, my guest, Professor Achmed, who was just on, will be on to talk about it. I also want to go into my concerns about debt. I believe that when you understand how the Federal Reserve is holding money, $1.3 trillion, in reserve for banks, and yet allowing the banks to make interest on it, yet charging the bank zero interest. Let's just see. Carolee just came in the studio. See if you can figure this out, Carolee. Let's say that you are a bank, all right?
Sure.
And you were bailed out because you made bad loans and you made bad gambles, right?
Okay.
So then you come to me, the Federal Reserve, and you say, I want some money. And I say, how much you want? So I take your bad debt. You say, we got all these terrible mortgages, and we got all these bad instruments. I say, oh, give them to me. So you give me $1 billion worth, right? And I give you $1 billion of interest-free money, clean money. I've laundered your money. Now let's say I say, oh, by the way, Carolee, I've got sitting over here in our vaults $1 billion for you. It's yours. No interest. We're even going to pay you 3% interest on it annually.
Great.
Yeah. That's what's happening. It's insane. It's fraud. It's theft. And that's what the American public's not aware of. And it's monetized, meaning no one's buying it. Meaning the Fed is buying the Treasury's debt, which if any other country did this, we would say, that's a Ponzi scheme. You can't do that. You can't monetize your debt. No. And we would immediately see hyperinflation. Well, we have almost no inflation, but we are going to see hyper deflation which means the value of your car, your jewelry, except for gold and silver, which I hope people were smart enough when I started telling. Remember when I told people getting the gold, they would have had a 300 to 400% appreciation in the value. In any case, your land, your house is going to go through the toilet. That's hyperdeflation. Let's say hello to, we have one person, I believe it's Dennis. Is it Dennis?
Yes.
Hi, Dennis from Brooklyn.
Yes.
Okay, you're on.
Yes. It's interesting that you should be commenting on religion, because the more and more I think about religion, and I was always sympathetic to certain groups and always felt like they weren't being treated fairly. But then when I began to read upon their belief system and where it came from and how it was spread and how it conquered other nations and wiped out their history and their civilizations, and now it's telling other countries, come out of our lands, you know, these are our lands, yet those were conquered lands by them and their belief system 1,400 years ago, right? And the
yes.
belief system, when you read about their leaders, where their ideology comes from, and I could get more specific if you allow me to.
Well, right now we don't have enough time. I'm just allowing people to call in and share their overview and their comments.
I mean, just imagine that you have so many people following the mindset of a person who's a murderer, a person who's a pedophile. And this mindset has allowed itself to spread. And then you have politicians that run the world and are responsible for your safety saying that this group is a group of peace. And I'm not even taking sides because, you know, all religions basically espouse the same thing.
Okay, but we're going to be doing an in-depth one-hour analysis of this on the nature of what religion historically, all religions have as far as the legitimacy of their writings, what happens when people become true believers, what happens when they take those parts of a religious doctrine and textual doctrine that allow a person to act out, whether it's a country acting out in the Crusades or individuals acting out to represent prejudice one against another. Those are dangers, but we must be very specific, and we will be, and we will do it in a dispassionate but a scholarly manner. Thank you. In studio, Kara Lee. Hi, Kara.
Oh, hey, Gary. Well, first of all, I wanted to make a quick announcement. We are, as I mentioned before, hiring a new nutritionist, and we're getting into some of our final rounds of interviews. And if you are somebody who's been hoping to, you know, squeeze some time in, get some free counseling, get some free nutrition help, we need a couple people to come by our Upper West Side studios on Monday afternoon, sometime between 2 and 4 o'clock, and you can get some free counseling by some of our potential new nutritionists. If you would be available Monday afternoon, please give me a call, 646-926-5428. Again, that number is 646-926-5428.
Let me explain what I'm doing. I have a lot of very qualified individuals who are applying for that job, and I don't know, just talking with them, which would be best, so I'm inviting them a chance to come in and counsel people with conditions. Well, I have a chance to sit there and listen to them. I want to see how they counsel, what insights they give. They are really the best people I could select and hire to help people with their positions, conditions. That's what I did with with all the healthcare providers that I've hired. I sit there and listen. That's what I'm going to do on Monday. I'm going to sit there and listen to them counsel people with different conditions and see how good they are at helping people. Did it with Pat Duncanson, and she's helped thousands of people since then. So we're going to hire someone full-time for the office and full-time for the store, but I have to first, in effect, audition them. And we're allowing people to come in who want to have a chance to have a, and these are all qualified, licensed practitioners, but I want to see how well they do.
And again, my phone number for that is 646-926-5428. And we only need a couple people, so there's only a few spots that we have. So please, if you're around on Monday, give me a call.
Okay, and we'll take one more call. All of my clocks are off here, so I don't know how much time I have, but I'll say hello to Anna in Serbia. Hi, Anna.
Hey, how are you? I heard your comment about Hillary Clinton and your prediction she will be next president of the United States.
A disaster.
She was recently visiting a Balkan and Serbia, and I heard local politicians saying how she tried to make peace between Kosovo and Serbian, but people are very sarcastic about her visit here. I don't know if you have followed her visit to Balkan and what's the point of her being here, because during the presidency of her husband, there was a very brutal bombing of Balkan for 90 days. It was very brutal. So I was just wondering if you can make some comments.
Well, first of all, that bombing included depleted uranium, and that depleted uranium has been impacting the health of the people in the entire Balkans area, in Croatia and other areas, since that bombing. There were other ways of approaching it. He did not have to subscribe to the bombing. She was a part of all the major decisions he made in the White House. The reason she's in the Balkans, the reasons that she is in the places she's in, is because in her need to be the next president, she had a weakness. Her major weakness was she had no experience, on-the-ground experience, in an official diplomatic position. As a wife, when you visit a country, you're not considered anything official. But she needed to get a better resume. Now she has that resume. She can say, I was in the Balkans. I was in Israel. I was in Africa. I met with the leaders. I helped them, you know, resolve their issues. That means that what others will not have, she will have, and then the Democrats will sweep her into office when they especially look at the likes of Sarah Palin, who will be running against her. And then what you will see in short order, you will see a whole new era of privatization, corporatization, militarization, and more debt. We will double the debt when Clinton takes office. Double it. And we will monetize that. And then the bad news is that we will go through the beginning of the big depression in America. The good news is, because of that, finally, the independent parties will start to emerge, and that will cause a change, a transformation, because they will never be elected again like that, because of the mess, that how bad it will be. So in effect, they win in the short term, but they will lose in the long term. Thank you very much for calling from Serbia, Anna. I appreciate it. We're out of time. Mike Fader, coming up right now on the Progressive Radio Network. And by the way, a 16% increase in our listenership in the last month alone. So from Serbia and everywhere else in the world, I'm Gary Nall. Thank you very much. Now, Mike Fader.
Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.